aws.org.
From WVUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The first day of Ramadan began in Baghdad today with bloodshed. Suicide bombs rocked the Iraqi capital, exploding at three police stations and Red Cross Red Crescent headquarters during morning rush hour. At least one American soldier and 34 Iraqis were killed. More than 200 Iraqis were wounded, making this the bloodiest day since the U.S. occupation began. President Bush today said the attack showed the enemy is growing desperate as the occupation makes progress. The coordinated attacks also show a sophistication and determination that has kept the chaos up since Saddam Hussein was overthrown. Up next On Point, more bombing in Iraq and the search for a way to really win this war. We begin in Washington with John Diamond, Pentagon correspondent for USA Today. I asked him how the Pentagon was responding to the news of the latest bombings in Baghdad.
There's dismay, obviously, but there's also a desire to continue to press the idea that the coalition is making progress. And there's an interesting gap emerging already between U.S. authorities in Iraq and U.S. authorities in Washington in terms of the interpretation of what's going on. In Washington, there's a view that this is foreign fighters, that this is part of the war on terrorism, that these are criminal bandits who have to be rounded up and stopped. In Iraq, the U.S. authorities tend to be more in line with the idea that these are Iraqi hardliners who are engaging in a guerrilla war, which obviously is a different political spin than saying that they're opportunistic terrorists.
John, does the Pentagon acknowledge that it's describing this differently from its commanders in the field? We heard today from Major General Raymond Odierno in Tikrit saying that it was only a very, very small percentage, in his words, of the people mounting attacks against Americans and their allies in Iraq that were from outside the country. Does the Pentagon acknowledge that difference?
Well, the Bush administration overall, again, today, including comments from the president, tending to place more emphasis on the foreign fighters. I think both in Washington and in Iraq, the authorities acknowledge that both are involved. But I just find that the emphasis is interesting. The administration at this point is taking the view that the step up in attacks reflects an increase in accomplishment by the coalition in the region, that the more they do, the better they do in terms of establishing political and physical stability, the more the hardliners will determine that there's a need to attack. And, of course, we have the Madrid conference, and so there's obviously a political message here, which is, you know, don't send your troops to this country because this country is very dangerous and the situation is a mess.
This is as donors try and figure out what exactly to send to Iraq.
Right.
But at the same time, these are real attacks, real deaths. Even Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz only missing him by one floor.
Right.
Is there a sense that the Pentagon may have to pursue some changes in strategy or tactics or timetable?
Yes. I mean, there's certainly what is now emerging and becoming clearer is the wide variety of the kinds of attacks and the gradually increasing level of violence from a roadside bomb that might endanger one or two or three people in a Humvee to shooting down helicopters to shooting at aircraft. This missile attack on a hotel, the three suicide bombs, that's yet another different method of attack. The rocket attack on the Al-Rashid Hotel was referred to by one intelligence official today as a sort of Trojan horse, a parked trailer that looked like a very common generator that you see all over Baghdad, and suddenly the door opens and you're looking at a couple of dozen rocket tubes. So there are many different methods, many different groups. It's hard to get a handle on who and where the enemy is.
If there's a different interpretation of what's going on in the field and in Washington, do you sense unease among military officials about that, among top-ranking officers who have to deliver in the field?
Yes, there's certainly a feeling that the tactics will have to change to a more of an offensive sort of search and destroy style of mission, which can result in casualties and can also increase the risk of involving civilians in the crossfire. And the difficulty there is that it may be the tactic that's needed to take down this enemy, but it may also, in the course of that, create new enemies by increasing levels of resentment among the Iraqi population.
What's the assessment in the Pentagon of the depth of the insurgency in Iraq and its staying power?
Well, this is interesting. And again, it seems to me to be a worrisome trend, because the consistent line from Washington has been to downplay the significance of the adversary, to say that there are a few hardliners, a few dead-enders, a few bandits, a few desperate terrorists, as opposed to saying we are up against a very serious enemy that needs to be taken seriously, that needs to be respected, albeit obviously no one's approving of, you know, suicide attacks or terrorism, but that needs to be respected as an enemy and taken on in a serious way. So I think that there is concern that this enemy is more formidable than officials in Washington are willing to acknowledge, because that acknowledgement has its own risks by suggesting that maybe things aren't going as well as the administration would like us to believe.
You have written that guerrillas in Iraq are in no danger of running out of munitions, of armaments.
That's right. There's been a number of stories about how there are unguarded caches of weapons. Thousands of caches of small arms have been found all over Iraq. No weapons of mass destruction yet, but lots of weapons of individual destruction. So many that the coalition does not have enough troops to guard them. The point of the story that is in today's USA Today is to say that even if you could guard all of those caches, guerrilla fighters have plenty of armaments of their own, material that they carried home with them when the Iraqi army essentially evaporated in the face of the U.S. Invasion, stores that they had hidden away that have not yet been discovered. And, of course, the attacks, though frequent and painful, are not so intense in the volume of fire that they use up all that much ammunition. So, you know, a dozen bombings or firefights a day doesn't use up that much material, but it causes a great deal of political damage and, of course, serious physical damage. We're now up to well over 1,500 wounded, and these are serious wounds that American soldiers are suffering. Much lower ratio of dead to wounded because of the skill of the medical personnel there and the body armor as well, but still a lot of people being seriously wounded as well as killed.
And finally, John, what about cooperation from Iraqis? Lots of Iraqi policemen died today, many of them trained and uniformed by the United States.
Yes.
Is there fear of Iraqis falling away from the United States for fear for their own lives?
Well, it certainly doesn't make it any easier to recruit police or to set up a gendarmerie, if you will, or to train a new Iraqi army. But it is a task that the coalition is taking on. They have put tens of thousands of troops and police into the field, and these are certainly in some parts of the country where it's risky. These are brave people who are taking on a dangerous job. At this point, there's no evidence of a flight away from this sort of volunteerism, because it is, you know, it's work that brings in a paycheck, and those are hard to come by in Iraq these days. But clearly, the terrorists are aiming not only at Americans, but also at Iraqis who collaborate with them, and they're trying to send a message there as well.
John, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
John Diamond covers the Pentagon for USA Today. He spoke with us from Washington. The coordinated attacks in Baghdad this morning came on the heels of a stunning weekend attack. At dawn on Sunday, 8 to 10 rockets slammed into the Al Rashid Hotel, one of them just one floor below the room where U.S. Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz slept. The U.S. military fingered foreign fighters and Saddam loyalists for the attacks. Whoever the enemy is, the body count and audacity of the attacks is mounting. Iraqi progress and confidence take a hit in the bloodshed tonight on Point. High-profile insurgency in Iraq. Did the bombings of the last 2 days look to you like desperation or escalation? Who's winning the propaganda war over Iraq? Bush with his reassurances, or the bombers with their death toll? And how will this war be won? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Lower Merion, Pennsylvania, is Ian Lustig, professor of political science at University of Pennsylvania and author of Unsettled States, Disputed Lands, Britain and Ireland, France and Algeria, Israel and the West Bank, Gaza. Good evening and welcome, Ian Lustig.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us tonight from Newport, Rhode Island, is Andrew Winner, professor of strategic studies at the Naval War College. He's a former analyst at the State Department Bureau of Political Military Affairs and worked on U.S. policy for containing Iraq after the first Gulf War. Good evening and welcome, Andrew Winner.
Good to be here.
Ian Lustig, to you first. So many questions today, but a simple one. Is the U.S. winning this war after the war in Iraq?
No, well, we're not winning it yet, and certainly we're not winning a propaganda war. In science, we always ask, what would it take to convince you that you were wrong? So when President Bush says that these attacks, these escalating attacks, show that we're winning, one wonders what would show him the opposite. That is, if there were no attacks, would he then say, well, peace and quiet is a bad sign. It shows we're not winning. No, it's the fact is that this is a propaganda kind of charm offensive, trying to spin it so fast that people lose sight of what's obviously happening.
So how do you interpret, then, what's actually going on?
Well, what's going on is the unraveling, the chickens coming home to roost of a policy that was not well thought out. We know now why, that people in the State Department and elsewhere who did develop planning for the post-war period, but which ran against the we'll get five straight heads when we flip the coin thinking in the Pentagon, that was rejected. So they went in there without a plan. They went in there with a half a plan to turn everything over to the Iraqi army. That was what Jay Garner was going to do. But then the army melted away, and it was officially disbanded, leaving Garner with absolutely nothing to do and nothing to do it with. So he and his staff essentially abandoned the administration. The administration then had to fall back on Plan B, but there appears not to have been a Plan B. And they're now, Bremer is put in, trying to put out the fires, trying to come up with something. I don't think in the long run he's going to be able to come up with anything that could be implemented successfully by the United States as opposed to a constituted Iraq under the auspices of the United Nations.
So that may mean U.S. out, U.N. in, but one wonders, would that really improve the situation? Andrew Winner, I guess the same question to you, first of all. Is the U.S. winning this war? Does this look like the insurgency acting out of desperation, as President Bush said today?
Well, I think Professor Lustig's answer of not yet is about right. And the problem is that we are, historians will be able to tell us, and as we look in the future, back on this, who mm-hmm. won and who lost. And I think it's very tough, and I would caution against generalizing from, spectacular attacks in the past day or two. Is this a blip? Is this a trend? Very tough to tell at this stage. We've had increases in violence and attacks and deaths and casualties on the coalition before, and then we've seen decreases. July was a particularly high month, and then it dropped back in August and September. So it's tough to say, are we seeing something that's an upward trend or indeed something that is a one-time event?
One way of tracking is this was the bloodiest day since the occupation began. What do you make of the sophistication of the timing of the attacks on the police stations, the rocket launcher attack mm-hmm. on the Al-Rashid?
Well, I think clearly the opposition is getting its political act together and putting together a campaign that has real solid political ends and combining it with their tactics on the ground. That shows, I think, better organization than we've seen heretofore on their part. And they clearly have a political agenda, which is to get the U.S. out and to restore some sort of regime, along the lines of what Saddam Hussein had in place. Certainly not something that we would call a Jeffersonian democracy.
I would like to make two points to follow up. One is, what can we learn more than we've said so far about the incompleteness of the American position there? One thing we can learn from what we've been seeing is that the attempt to categorize what we're doing in the occupation of Iraq is similar to the occupation of Germany and Japan mm-hmm. has been completely invalidated. There was not a single shot fired, no American killed in anger by any Japanese or German once the occupation began. This is a completely different kettle of fish.
A kettle of fish that looks more like what?
Like Vietnam or like the West Bank. That is, Israel has been occupying the West Bank in an intensive way for 35 years, and they still haven't been able to stop popular resistance against their rule, even if that popular resistance in its extreme form does not have the support necessarily of the whole population. It's just a very, very difficult thing to do.
Ian Lustig, hold your second thought. We've got to take a short break. We'll be right back. We're talking with Ian Lustig at the University of Pennsylvania and Andrew Winner, at the Professor of Strategic Studies at the Naval War College. You can join the conversation. Do the bombings of the last 2 days look like desperation or escalation to you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the wave of suicide bombings in Baghdad and insurgency versus occupation in Iraq. We're joined by Ian Lustig from the University of Pennsylvania and Andrew Winner from the Naval War College. You can join the conversation as well. Is it clear to you who's winning this war? Does it matter if it's foreigners or Iraqis doing the bombings? And could the United States somehow change its strategy or tactics to calm Iraq more effectively? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. President Bush spoke this morning after meeting with Iraqi occupation head Paul Bremer and U.S. military commander General John Abizaid. President Bush said he remains, quote, even more determined to work with the Iraqi people, unquote, to restore peace to the nation.
The more progress we make on the ground, the more free the Iraqis become, the more electricity is available, the more jobs are available, the more kids that are going to school, the more desperate these killers become because they can't stand the thought of a free society.
President Bush, this morning, Ian Lustig, you had a second point coming there, and we want to hear it, but I want to ask you first, what about the equation that the president is making between the number of school playgrounds rebuilt and the number of miles of electrical wire laid and the presumption that that will lead to more stability? Is that a fair equation? It's got a kind of obvious sense to it.
Yes, it's a tough sell. It's a hearts and minds argument. When Americans would like to think that making people happy on the ground who are apolitical will determine the outcome of a situation, but in a highly politicized, violent environment, such as that of Iraq or any guerrilla war situation, it's not so much the upside but the fear of the downside that drives people. That is, people waited during the war in Iraq until it was clear the United States was going to win a victory, until they came out in the streets and took down the statues. They did not rise up. They were waiting until there was a tipping point where everybody could agree that, okay, the future is going to be America. We're really battling not to build more schools per se, but to create a massive expectation that it's inevitable that this resistance will be crushed. Until that, if that inevitability is challenged, as this escalation is challenging it, that's the real threat to our position, because as was said in the introduction to your program, It might lead us into larger scale reprisal and search and destroy operations, which would start to destroy the potential base of goodwill that we still may have among many Iraqis. That's the real danger. The second thought that I had that I want to share,
please,
is that when you're in a guerrilla war like this, the main thing you need is intelligence. And that's what it's shockingly apparent that we don't have. We've been in there for months fighting an enemy, and the government still can't agree who it is we're fighting or who's carrying this out. We've arrested apparently hundreds, even thousands of people. We don't know how many of them are still being held, but we don't know what kind of information we've received. As long as people are worried that the situation might tip away from the United States, they could withhold the information that we need. I, for example, think that Hezbollah might very well be involved in these attacks.
Hezbollah?
Yes.
With its bases in Lebanon.
They're Shia, based in Lebanon. We know that one person was found with a Syrian passport. They would come through Syria to get to Iraq. They're known to use Katyusha rockets, that's their specialty, and roadside bombs, another thing that's been prominent in the attacks in Iraq. They don't tend to claim responsibility for acts. They're very sophisticated about it. I think when we're talking about our enemies, our opponents in Iraq, there's a whole array of them.
And what would Hezbollah's incentive be to take the U.S. on in Iraq?
Well, they would be in league with the Shia of Iraq. Just because these attacks are taking place in the Sunni triangle doesn't mean they're carried out by Sunni.
With the goal of establishing a Shia-dominated state like Iran, or just bloodying Washington's nose?
Islam, a place where parties like Hezbollah dominate the political scene. And they can probably raise support from their backers, wherever they are, from a tax they make on the United States. They claim credit for that. The United States has created political and financial opportunities for Muslim groups, terrorist groups from all over the world by putting 130,000 American targets in the middle of the Middle East. And we're seeing Hezbollah perhaps take advantage of that, and I expect al-Qaeda as well.
Andrew Winner, our producers here were in email communication today with Brigadier General Mark Hertling. He's with the Army's 1st Armored Division in Iraq. He said, who we're fighting right now? He was asked and he answered, right now we're fighting in priority. First, former regime loyalists. They've got an acronym now, FRL, who want the return of the days of Saddam when they have the majority of wealth, property, resources of the country. Secondly, he points to criminals and thugs. He says 20,000 or so released by Saddam at the beginning of the U.S. Attack there. And finally, he says some foreign fighters.
Right.
He pointed to the suicide attacks in the last day or today as evidence of that. Does that sound like a fair estimation? What about the Hezbollah idea?
They're certainly fighting a cross section. There's a variety of groups, and I think all three of those are there. What percentage they make up of the opposition is anybody's guess. Certainly, the U.S. is trying to get a handle on what the proportions are because that determines to some degree how they go after them. But it's a very difficult thing to do. I mean, the former regime loyalist pool, too, could be very large, even though all of them may not have picked up weapons yet. At the beginning of the war, the best estimates, and they're very rough estimates, of Saddam's fedayeen, these folks who were around, was about 60,000. There were probably between one and two Republican Guard divisions who were never really attacked frontally by U.S. ground forces and just faded away. When Baghdad fell, where are those folks? Now, not every one of them may be part of the opposition, but there's certainly a fairly good-sized force pool to draw from should they feel that the U.S. is on the retreat and they better get back into it.
So how would you describe the way the U.S.-led force is taking these groups on so far, and are there changes in tactics that they might want to use? General Hertzling was vague, but he said that they'll be making a shift in our counterinsurgency operations over the next few months. What is it? What might it? What ought it be?
Well, they certainly have got to, they have a combination of things. One, they have a real focus on force protection because they don't want to get American soldiers killed.
Does that mean hunkering down?
That means hunkering down or, making sure you're traveled in armored vehicles, not lightly armored Humvees, more in the Bradleys and the M1s. Making sure you've got adequate protection in your supply convoys, maybe repositioning some of your forces from more vulnerable areas. But then they clearly have to go out and, do these sort of search and destroy missions. Ideally, they want to do them in a very surgical manner so that they don't, end up capturing too many civilians who aren't involved, destroying property, and, earning enmity from the average Iraqi. Commanders on the ground over the past few months have said that they have seen a correlation between good works and good security with the number of tips they get from the population. When you have an area that is relatively pacified and where there's reconstruction projects going on, then the local Iraqis, get that feeling that maybe things are going to turn out all right in the end. You're not going to see a return to the former regime or something like it. And they are therefore more willing to provide intelligence information on some of the insurgents who may be hiding among them. Professor Lustig said, if they feel that things are going to get worse, they are going to hunker down themselves, the average Iraqi, and not provide that. And they're all performing this calculus every single day. Do they feel that things are going to go one way or the other? And how should they act toward the coalition or toward some of the insurgents who may be in their midst on a daily basis?
Right next door. Listeners, we're talking tonight about the wave of suicide bombings in Baghdad and insurgency versus occupation in Iraq. You can join us. Who's winning the propaganda war? Bush with his reassurances or the bombers with their death toll? And can the United States win if it can't stop the bombings? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to welcome into our conversation now Colonel Robert Killebrew. He's joining us from Newport News, Virginia. He's a retired Army colonel who taught strategy at the Army War College. He now consults on national security issues. Good evening and welcome, Colonel Robert Killebrew.
Good evening, sir, and to all your guests.
Thanks for joining us. We have asked all of our guests tonight whether the U.S. is winning in Iraq. So far, the answer is, from Andrew Winner and Ian Lustig, certainly not yet. What's your view? How's this campaign going?
I tend to agree. I think the jury's still out. But I would like to make a couple of points that just came up in your conversations with your previous guests.
Mm-hmm.
Point number one is the absolute need for battlefield intelligence. I absolutely agree more. Couldn't agree more fervently. In fact, the Army itself in its most recent lessons learned document points out that we're still not getting the performance out of the battlefield intelligence systems that we should.
What do you mean battlefield intelligence in an occupation period?
Well, let me offer you two thoughts. Thought number one is, we keep calling this an occupation, but it's not really. We're still at war.
Mm-hmm.
This is the second stage of a war that started with our invasion and that will continue probably until most of the terrorist attacks stop and we can go to a true occupation mode a la Germany in 1950.
But there's a kind of tension built in here. On the one hand, we can all see and we hear the generals in the field still calling it war, but Washington is working very hard to portray it as a realm of redevelopment and reconstruction.
Well, you can have redevelopment and reconstruction going on in the middle of the war.
Okay.
But for a theorist of war, which mm-hmm. is why you asked me to come up on this show,
yep.
I'll tell you this is still warfare.
Mm-hmm.
This is a stage of warfare that's de-escalated from major unit warfare, perhaps. But if you talk to the troops in Iraq, as you just talked about, it's war.
So what's the problem with getting that battlefield intelligence, and why isn't it coming in?
Because the battlefield intelligence systems that we've built and fielded aren't designed to deal with human intelligence from the bottom up. They're really designed to receive intelligence from the top down primarily and maneuver large units. Now, I know the Army's trying to do something about that, but the fact is, and this is not just an Army problem, the intelligence field over the past several years has gotten very intensively oriented on electronic intelligence.
So you're describing satellites looking down and
yeah.
AWACS looking down, all the battlefield stuff we've seen.
All that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't really help you when you're confronting a house full of Iraqis and you have to ask, where is your uncle tonight? We'd like to talk to him.
Does the U.S. have the capacity to field that kind of intelligence operation or even to build it in these circumstances?
Not proven. My experience is if you want to build that kind of intelligence infrastructure, you have to start several years before. And I'm not quite sure we've got it to the extent that we can put it into the field in the numbers we need.
Well, certainly we have a situation where the U.S. has to go with, at the very least, whatever linguists they have.
Mm-hmm.
You can't create an Arab linguist overnight. This is something that takes years and years. So you have a set pool, both in the Army, the intelligence community, and the diplomatic community that you can draw upon, and that's as many as you have.
That's particularly true in the fields of intelligence that require specialized skills. You can't easily start to produce those people overnight.
So let's ask on that point, if the number of linguists, just for starters, is too small,
Yep. Is
that an insurmountable obstacle to winning?
Well, let's not get carried away by that detail. Let's see what the real importance of that is.
Mm-hmm.
The importance is it reflects on the extent to which politics has been, that is, political interests have been driving the use of intelligence and the misuse of intelligence. I couldn't agree more with my colleague who gave a professional military assessment. Another way of saying what he said is that we were completely unprepared to fight the kind of war we found ourselves in. We don't have the bottom-up intelligence. We don't even have troops oriented in the proper way. One reason is because the purpose of the war, those who did the war, implemented it, had in mind that it wouldn't and couldn't be a war like that. It had to be a war that could be fightable technically and from the top down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, in that context, I'm very afraid that the intelligence issue on who these people are is being cooked in the same way that the WMD stuff was cooked before the war.
Cooked in what direction, Ian Lustig?
We have so many linguists that are out there searching for non-existent WMD when they ought to be helping our soldiers protect themselves and find out who these attackers are. I think there's a studied attempt to say that more of these attacks are thugs and hardcore Saddam supporters than there are, for crying out loud.
So who do you think they are?
How many thugs and Saddam supporters are going to blow themselves up? These suicide bombers are not Saddamites, and they're not
thugs. Hezbollah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're highly motivated people, and they're the ones who are causing the real terrible destruction.
Robert Killebrew?
Let's talk for a second about what winning this war means, because that was the part of the question
yes,
I wanted
please.
To get to.
Mm-hmm.
I would put to you that the target right now for the terrorists is not, strictly speaking, the United States. It's to prevent the emergence of an Iraqi government that's moderate. I believe that to be their true target.
Mm-hmm.
And for that reason, you're seeing them increasingly targeting Iraqi infrastructure.
But does that mean that they would be amenable to an immoderate Iraqi regime that supported Washington? Let's say something far less than a democracy?
I'm not sure, because I don't believe they've published a political agenda yet. This came up earlier in your discussion.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen or heard, perhaps your other guests have, a statement from anything like the Viet Cong Front or something like that that would announce what they want.
Robert Kilhew, let me ask you a really simple question, because we're hearing some concern about maybe fundamental things missing from the U.S. effort there. Are you confident that the U.S. will win this effort, whatever that may mean? Many people alive in the United States today have seen the U.S. pull out of a major military effort when it faced an insurgency in Vietnam and again in Lebanon. Can you foresee that as an option here?
No, I don't see that as an option at all. And I think, in fact, we will adapt, and I think, in fact, we will win. And I define winning as the installation of a moderate, sustainable Iraqi regime in a couple of years that's able to handle its own internal problems, including terrorism.
And Lustig, what do you think of that definition, and do you think the U.S. can achieve it in a couple of years?
Well, President Bush set a little bit of a higher standard for winning. He wants a prosperous, free Iraq. I do not believe we – I'm not saying a prosperous, free Iraq is impossible, but it can't be built by the United States. And I do not believe that we can win the war as my colleague has defined winning, that is, creating a self-sustaining regime that we can leave. If you even look at South Korea, I mean, look at Germany, we hardly leave anywhere except, as you pointed out, Lebanon, Vietnam, Somalia, where we are driven out. We it takes us an awful long time to leave a place. So I can't imagine that in a few years we're going to have a regime there that we're just going to leave behind and it's going to be self-sustaining.
Mm-hmm.
I think the exit strategy has been and still is to turn this into a kind of UN trusteeship. It'll be a bitter pill for many in Washington to swallow. We're going to have to fund a good deal of it, but we will not be able, with our hands and our companies, to rebuild Iraq. That's going to have to be done by the international community with American help.
And you think they could do it if the United States cannot?
Excuse me?
Do you think the UN, a UN-led group, could do it if and when the United States cannot?
The longer we wait, the less likely it is that they'll be able to do it. We should have done this a long time ago. If we were going to invade, we should have, after the declaration of the end of major hostilities, worked with the UN. I personally think it was a huge mistake to go in there without a UN flag to begin with, but they're the only ones who can do it. Whether they can do it and whether they'll be able to do it after another 6 months of this is an open question,
well,
but I do not believe the United States
can do it. Let's talk for a second about facts on the ground, though. The UN is not a construction agency. Neither are the pieces of the UN. The constituent countries put up money, donor countries do, and then a UN agency or a U.S. agency goes out and hires construction companies. My own evaluation is that probably the task of reconstructing Iraq in the end will be done by the Iraqis themselves, who, as we know, we said before the war, are a talented, fairly sophisticated for the region population, perfectly capable of paving their own roads and building their own bridges.
But they need a little stability to do that. Robert Kilhew, Andrew Winner, Ian Lustig, please stand by. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the wave of suicide bombings in Baghdad and insurgency versus occupation in Iraq. My guest tonight, Ian Lustig, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Unsettled States, Disputed Lands. Joining us from Newport, Rhode Island, Andrew Winner, professor of strategic studies at the Naval War College. And from Newport News, Virginia, Colonel Robert Kilhew, retired Army colonel. He taught strategy at the Army War College. You can join us tonight, though we're having some trouble, I must tell you, with our phones, and things are just trickling through. I'm sorry it's so difficult, but we are at 1-800-423-8255. Early yesterday morning in Baghdad, 8 to 10 rockets slammed into the Al-Rashid Hotel, sort of the heartland of the U.S. occupation in Iraq. Hundreds of American officials and business people staying there, including among the guests at the hotel yesterday morning, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Paul Wolfowitz, one of the main architects of the war with Iraq. We are told that one of the rockets hit one floor down from where Paul Wolfowitz was staying. A U.S. Army colonel was killed in the attack, the highest ranking U.S. Army official, military official killed to date in Iraq. The Secretary of Defense, or Deputy Secretary, was audibly shaken after the attack on the hotel. He quickly condemned the attack and reasserted the resolve of the U.S.-led fight to secure Iraq. Let's listen.
This terrorist act will not deter us from completing our mission, which is to help the Iraqi people free themselves from the type of criminals who did this and to protect the American people from this kind of terrorism.
Paul Wolfowitz, after an attack on the hotel where he was staying just yesterday morning. Heather's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Heather. You're on the air. Hello, Heather. Are you there? Oh, the phones are giving us way too much trouble tonight. Andrew Winter, let me turn to you, if I may, about this issue of command and control of what's going on. To witness what happened yesterday, where a jerry-rigged rocket launcher was brought into proximity of the Al-Rashid Hotel, and then these coordinated attacks this morning, how tight a command and control do these suggest? Is there a big bunker somewhere with Saddam Hussein or Hezbollah or Al-Qaeda in it, plotting all this on a big chart?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think this suggests that there is at least some, you know, fairly intelligent, sophisticated mind behind at least these attacks. Now, does that person or persons have control over a wide group of forces? It's difficult to say. I mean, we should remember that it was, the Al-Qaeda organization, but in the end, 19 people in a cell that perpetrated September 11th, and that was fairly sophisticated and had an awful large impact, obviously. So it doesn't mean that, this is a brigade size or division size, opposition with a span of control across all of Iraq.
And I enlist the same question to you. Saddam is missing. Billions of dollars are missing. We've read stories of people being paid to make these attacks. Others, like the Syrian arrested today when his attack failed, still shaking his fist all the way down. Do you picture a command center somewhere?
I agree with what was said. I picture several command centers, each one of which may have a high or medium level of coordination, but I don't necessarily think they're coordinated among themselves. In fact, they may be competing with one another, which may be even worse. First of all, it would be harder to unravel a resistance that was split into many different parts and operated in different ways. But I want to stress this: the fact that so many of these attacks are suicides. It's not easy to pay people to commit suicide. The money that Saddam has, and I'm sure he has a lot of it, can be used to generate intelligence, support, bribe officials. It can be used to generate soldiers without jobs going out and planting mines or attacking from the sidelines a convoy with some small arms. But it cannot produce these waves of suicide bombers. Those people, wherever we may think of them, are committed. And that means they're coming from some other kind of organization. They're not thugs, and they're not simply holdouts, loyalists to Saddam. We don't, for example, see, we see a heroic Iraqi policeman. I don't know how many more of them we will see, but we do see them. But we, how hard would it be to find Iraqis ready to commit suicide on behalf of the American project in Iraq? It's not clear if there are as many as are ready to commit suicide to drive the United States out.
And Robert Killebrew, does that suggest to you, as it does to Ian Lustig, that we're looking at quite possibly terrorists from different realms, Hezbollah? I mean, it must not be easy to get multiple suicide bombers up and ready to go. That does sound more like the Hezbollah way.
Well, listening to all of this, it strikes me how much we don't know. We don't know, for example, where the suicide bombers are coming from. I agree that that kind of dedication is not found everywhere easily. But there were, in fact, Iraqi Fayyadin that committed suicide during the attacks by U.S. conventional forces. There's no reason to assume that they're not still out there. We just don't know now, and I think that's what's perplexing all of us. We can agree that there's some kind of a mix of Ba'athist loyalists, common criminals perhaps, and certainly some terrorists from other countries. We can agree that there are probably several command centers or nodes of some kind that are coordinating these attacks. I agree with my colleague who said at the present time it's better if they're not connected for them, because then one cracked doesn't lead to cracking others. The fact is, though, we don't know what their political objective is. We don't know how many of them there are. I suggest, getting back to the intelligence problem, that we will solve our intelligence problems as the Iraqi police and the Iraqi government itself comes online, thereby offsetting our lack of trained Arabic speakers.
Let me try and turn once more to the phones here. I think they're up and working now. Kathleen's on the line. Hi, Kathleen. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. Good evening.
Good evening. I can hear you.
Great. What's your question or comment, Kathleen?
Well, my comment is, I mean, I'm old enough to have been through Vietnam. And, you know, Syria is beginning to smell like Cambodia.
Syria next door to Iraq, yeah.
Right. The outside terrorists, the outside agitators, the people moving in, not enough intelligence on the ground, concepts of surgical strike, search and destroy. This is very familiar territory. One news issue that never got to, that I could see the Globe, was that we went in and arrested some old women, mothers of people we wanted. That's sure to win the hearts and minds of people in Iraq. We don't know what we're doing. We don't know about the country. We are very alienated in that area. We never should have gone in. And the only way I see us getting out is through the UN.
So you're saying, let's do it. Let's go with Ian Lustig's notion and bring the UN. Are you confident, Kathleen, that that would bring a solution to this?
Well, I think that just having America there, we're not an honest broker. Just like in Israel, we're not an honest broker. People there do not trust us, and they shouldn't trust us. You know, Bush talks about, and I keep trying to say Nixon instead of Bush, and I'm sorry, but
a little late for that.
Bush talks about the Marshall Plan. This isn't Germany. One of the things that Truman went out of his way to do was to make sure that there was no corporate cronyism. Does that sound familiar? Has Bush done that? Not even close. We at home are suspicious. Those of us opposed to the war to begin with, it's worse than we thought. And now as the body count goes up for each day, I think Americans will lose faith, as they should. My fear is that we will exit that country without supporting, giving a structure to the country like the UN. I do think we'll exit.
But you're not sure we'll do it well. Kathleen, thanks for the call. Andrew Winter, let me put the Vietnam idea to you. For listeners of a certain age, the drumbeat, the drip torture of death, the comparison becomes a kind of inevitable. Is it relevant here? Is it useful or not, in your view?
I don't think it's terribly useful. I think what I have seen and read, as everyone picks their own historical analogy, depending on their sort of views going in on this, whether it's World War II, whether it's Vietnam, maybe a more apt one is the Philippines at the turn of the last century, where we went in and there was a fairly long opposition and insurgency, and the U.S. eventually put that insurgency down.
But that's hardly comforting. I mean, there were hundreds of thousands of deaths in that bad fight.
And it took 50 years.
Can I come in on this?
Robert Killebrew.
I'll speak to Kathleen directly. I'm a Vietnam veteran, had two tours there. Both with the Vietnamese people and the Vietnamese army. From what I see now, Kathleen, this has not yet reached the Vietnam analogy.
And why not?
We haven't yet. What we're fighting now is urban terrorism. It hasn't escalated in any way close to what we faced in Vietnam, and the term quagmire does not yet apply. Now, the question that...
Explain on each of those, why not? How is it different on each of those vectors, Robert Killebrew?
Okay. And the Vietnam quagmire became a quagmire when we could neither win nor withdraw with any kind of decency.
Mm-hmm.
It was caused by, I believe, the order that went out during Lyndon Johnson's term that U.S. troops would cease offensive operations, confine themselves to bases, and then Nixon came in and began Vietnamization. And so the U.S. Army, anyway, stagnated for about 2 to 3 years in Vietnam until we got the out in 72. We are nowhere near that today.
Well, could I comment on this?
Please.
One of the terrible plagues that could afflict us as a result of this war is that the whole country has to refight the Vietnam War again.
Absolutely.
The whole country being the United States.
The interpretation that we just heard, that if only we'd stayed the course more aggressively for a longer period, we would have won. Again, looking to the Philippines desperately for an analogy, there simply is no analogy.
That's right.
The United States that went into a country in the Third World, occupied it, overthrew the regime, rebuilt it, and then left successfully. It's never been done, not only by the United States, but no other Western power. I do disagree with Kathleen in one respect. There is one great difference in the way the United States is handling the body count now and in Vietnam. And that is that in Vietnam, every week we were told how many Americans were killed, and we were told a figure for how many Vietnamese were killed. Here, we're only told how many Americans are killed. They're not even counting the Iraqis.
And what do you make of that?
Not necessarily suspicious, but somewhat embarrassing.
Because what do you make of it? The number's high, low?
It's an attempt to try to prevent the opposition from using propaganda against us of how many Iraqis Americans are killing, whether, you know, intentionally by accident or by the fear that our soldiers get subjected to, surrounded by a potentially hostile environment. So, but I think it is somewhat disreputable for the United States to present itself as so concerned with the death of innocents to terrorism, and when innocents die by our hands, and we agree they're innocent often because of accidental or overreactions, we don't even count them. The government's policy is not to count Iraqi casualties.
That's an invisible number.
That's a difference from Vietnam, even though we may have inflated or miscounted Vietnamese. At least we reported that we were killing some.
Jeff's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening.
Good evening. Thank you.
Sure. A very interesting conversation. I'd just like to emphasize what I think is an underestimation of the opposition. Saddam Hussein had 30 years to develop the extremely elaborate structures of domination. The Mukhabarat and several other Secret Service organizations, of course, the Republican Guard, as mentioned, and in the 90s, this particularly iniquitous organization of the Fedayeen Saddam.
Mm-hmm. So?
And they have absolutely no investment in any future that the U.S. has in mind. And every motivation, virtually every last one of them, I mean, not the people who were in the major ministries and stuff, but all these others, and there are tens of thousands of them.
You're saying they don't imagine them, they can't see themselves as participants in a happy, prosperous democracy down the road?
No, because they have been disenfranchised and will probably be put up on charges, when possible.
Which sort of cements them as an opposition. Ayn Lustig, how about it? Do you see them as implacable?
Yes, I don't see the people who are involved in this, unless they're Army veterans who are out of a job. And that raises the question of whether we made a catastrophic error by disbanding the Iraqi Army and not allowing it to function in a way that would suck up at least part of the pool of available angry men.
Could that decision be reversed even now?
Saddam and his cronies.
Could that be reversed even now?
Well, I believe it can, but probably only under the auspices of the United Nations. I don't believe that an Iraqi army built up under the auspices of the United States will have the political cover it needs to rebuild an Iraq that can be self-sustaining. Any Iraq that is built up under the American auspices, I can't imagine how in today's Middle East it can sustain itself after we leave.
And Andrew Winner, are you similarly pessimistic about an Iraqi military force?
No, I'm not, in large part because you have a bunch of implacable opponents. I agree on that point. But you also have a very large population, many of whom were completely disenfranchised under Saddam. And they have equally strong incentives to ensure that Iraq does not go back to Saddam or to that type of rule. And so they are going to work very hard to try to put in place a political structure in which they can live much more freely than they did over the past 30 years.
A big test for everyone coming up. Robert Killebrew, Andrew Winner, Ayn Lustig, I want to thank each of you for being with us tonight. It's been great. Thanks so much for coming on.
My pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.